Together, let's move Australia forward.
You're listening to Never Talk Politics.
Hey guys, I'm Steph McDonald.
And I'm Nick Appleby.
And welcome to another episode of Never Talk Politics, the show that brings you important issues with real people who shape your community. So what's in store for our listeners this week, Nick?
Well, this week we're going to take a look at the food security issue. Food security is a major concern not only in Australia but across the globe. Food shortage is already an issue in many third world countries, and this is only going to get worse with the world's population expected to reach 9 billion by 2050. So I'm wondering what we're doing in Australia to secure our food supplies.
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm also thinking about whether the government is paying enough attention to the food shortage crisis. The government is pushing for a big Australia, but is this really sustainable? With climate change, rising fuel costs, water and land shortages contributing to the problem, it's something that I think needs serious attention.
So, Steph, who are you going to chat to today to try and answer some of these questions?
I'm going to chat with Alex Girdwood, who's involved with the Sydney Food Fairness Alliance, and Professor Jim Scott from the Uni of New England.
Sounds good. I'll be chatting with Bathurst farmer and head of the Market Gardening Co-op, Ross McKindo, about small-scale farming techniques. But before this, I'm off on my weekly trip around the world. Firstly, to the Australian Parliament, and Victorian Labor MP Harry Jenkins has been unanimously elected as Speaker for a second term. Mr. Jenkins was dragged to the Speaker's chair by fellow Labor MPs Steve Georgiannis and Sharon Bird as part of the Theatre of the Parliament, marking a tradition inherited from Britain. Mr. Jenkins has the responsibility of umpiring the first hung Parliament in 70 years, with Prime Minister Julia Gillard leading with a minority government.
On this occasion, in this Parliament, there is this great opportunity.
Liberal MP Peter Slipper, who is the government's candidate for the position, has been elected as Deputy Speaker of the House of Representatives following a secret ballot. Now to India, and thousands of tickets to the Delhi Commonwealth Games remain unsold just days before the Games are set to begin. The troubled event, already plagued by an outbreak of dengue fever, collapsing facilities and doubts about transport, fire and evacuation procedures, was hit with another blow when world 800-metre champion Caster Semenya pulled out on Tuesday. Rather than a feeling of excitement and celebration that usually precedes the Games, many in India feel that the Games may well be a disaster.
A negative kind of a vibe is all over the capital, but I guess, you know, what is really required right now is, rather than criticizing, just having a positive point of view about it. And I guess it will just help them to cope up with the Games rather than, you know, it's putting a lot of pressures, and I don't think Indians work well with pressures.
Organisers have promised that all the accommodation will be finished on time and that full security is now in place to protect venues and participants. And finally to Egypt, where billionaire tycoon Hisham Talat Mustafa has escaped the death sentence, receiving only 15 years in prison for ordering the 2008 slaying of his lover. The murder case, involving a former member of parliament and a Lebanese pop diva, Suzanne Tamim, was regarded by many Egyptians as a test of whether the wealthy can escape justice. The court heard that the spurned billionaire paid $2 million to a security guard in one of his resorts to kill a pop singer whose career was on the downhill. There were DNA matches, credit card slips, and other evidence to condemn Mustafa, but from the trial's outset, few believed that a man so rich and powerful would receive a tough verdict. And that's what's happening around the world. I'm Nick Appleby.
Hey, I'm Steph McDonald. This week on Never Talk Politics, we're looking at the food shortage and security issue. Today I'm speaking with Professor Jim Scott from the School of Environmental and Rural Sciences at the University of New England. He's had a lot of experience and done research with farming sustainability, farming systems, and how to manage pastures through drought and grazing stress. As most of us are not farmers, we don't understand the hardships and challenges that come with being a farmer. And with increasing demand for food and produce, it just makes it more difficult for them to do their job.
The fundamental problem, I believe, for farmers is that they are considered by society that 95% of society are not farmers, and they consider the farmer should be a price taker. That means that the farmers have to really accept what the market will bear. Whereas when a company sells an iPhone or a Toyota or something, society believes that they believe that if they've got increased costs of production, it's fair enough to charge more for that product, that consumer product. But in the case of food, that's not the case. When we put more regulations on farmers and we want the environment fixed up, there's no part on the invoice that the farmer who's selling their wool or their meat or their wheat, there's no part of the invoice where they can invoice the consumer of their product for looking after the environment. And this is a big, big problem that really humanity has to deal with across the globe. We have to find better ways of rewarding farmers to keep them in business, to allow them to have a reasonable quality of life with their families, but also to fund them sufficiently so that they can look after the natural resources that will bring us the next meal next year and the decade after that and the generation after that. If we don't support them in that way, if we don't find a clever way to reward them for looking after the environment, then I'm afraid we will continue to see globally degradation of the natural resources. And today we find that there's declining areas of high quality soil around the world, and we can't afford to do that for too much longer before we're in real trouble, because there's a need to dramatically increase the amount of food produced, not only to feed the growing population of the world, but to feed those billion or so people who are hungry, and even more than a billion people who are currently malnourished. So there's some really huge tasks for us, and one of the biggest problems, I think, is that all of us who are well fed, most of us, take food and fibre for granted, and we don't think about the connection between our purchase of food and sustaining the natural resources that allow that food to be produced.
What is the direction that sustainable farming will be heading in the near future?
I hope it's onward and ever upward, but I'm afraid we don't have a long-term commitment to sustainability. We have a Minister for Sustainability and for Populations in Australia now, but really, to date, our governments, our systems haven't yet adopted intergenerational timeframes into their thinking to enable us to really develop good networks of trusted information. I'm afraid that today most of our efforts tend to be on a political time frame of something like 3 years, and while ever we're in that mode, we will be having a great trouble in really demonstrating to anybody's objective satisfaction that we've really been achieving sustainable food production. So it really remains a huge question for us, and it's very hard to persuade people to fund things for longer periods. And I'm afraid until we get into that intergenerational time frame and make real commitments to it, we're in big trouble, because the amounts of money we actually spend on research in Australia are diminishing, and yet in some facets of society we spend squillions of dollars developing new technologies and wonderful exciting things in society, but it tends not to be in the area of food and fibre production. That funding has been diminishing for a long time, and it doesn't show any signs to date of changing. But I really do think this is this message I've been trying to tell you about, these concepts are quite difficult for many people to come to terms with, because we are well fed and we are, as a society, generally fairly complacent about our food supplies. You know, the food is always there in the supermarket and it's great and it's nice. But really, the proportion of that price that you pay, a very, very small proportion of it, sometimes only one-fifth, sometimes only one-tenth of the price you pay, actually goes to the farmer. And when you think that you can pay as much for a bottle of water as you pay for a bottle of milk, which is a very complex product which costs a lot of money to produce compared to water, then you can see some of the silly perverse outcomes that have happened in our marketplace. So I would encourage all people who eat, and that's everyone, to really think deeply about the resources, the natural resources and their maintenance, and how their price that they pay is communicated through to supporting future production of quality and safe food. And in order to do that, I'm afraid we're going to need a bit of a revolution to improve that system so that our farmers sufficiently rewarded, not only to sustain their families, but also to look after our capital, our natural capital, so that we can live on the interest and not the capital into the future.
You're listening to Never Talk Politics on the Community Radio Network.
All right.
Hi, I'm Nick Appleby. Well, many believe that when it comes to securing food supplies in the future, new technologies like genetically modified foods are the way to go. But some people, like the head of the Bathurst Market Gardening Co-op, Ross McKindo, think that the answer lies in keeping produce organic and local. The beauty of market gardening is that fresh food can go from the producer to the consumer without the pollution of packaging and transport. I got Ross into the studio to talk about his views on the future of agriculture in Australia. So how are you, Ross?
Good, thanks, Nick.
Good, that's good. So you've spent some time in Cambodia looking at the comparisons between third world and first world agriculture. Could you tell me a little bit about that, what you've learned?
I worked for the Ministry of Agriculture in Australia for 30, 40 years. But towards the end of my career, I had the unique opportunity of going to Cambodia to help the Ministry of Agriculture in Cambodia establish their, what's called their Agricultural Extension Service, is their Farmer Advisory Service. We weren't trying to change the agricultural technology in any way, not directly. So we didn't want to get involved in that.
Is that because they've been using various techniques for
hundreds of years, yes. And they've learned from their fathers and their grandfathers and their great-grandfathers how to do things under certain circumstances that arise from time to time in agriculture. Cambodian farmers are driven very much by risk minimization. What's the least risky thing to do? They're subsistence farmers. They're growing all their own food. If they don't grow it themselves, they'd starve in many cases. So they're subsistence farmers who sell their surplus.
So obviously they'd have to cater for probably for a lot more people than we would. Has that taught you anything about, you know, food security that could be used in Australia?
Their ability to utilise quite small areas of land with a lot of manual labour, very labour-intensive systems of agriculture. It was, quite a fascinating comparison between Cambodian agriculture and Australian agriculture, because Australian agriculture, in my lifetime, the numbers of farmers has just decreased dramatically, but the size of the remaining farmers has increased dramatically. And the systems of agriculture are very dependent on mechanisation, use of fertilisers and chemical sprays of one sort or another. And sure, we're producing a lot of cheap food, but we're doing it at a great cost to the environment and now at a great cost to the climate. Agriculture is the third largest emitter of greenhouse gas emissions as an industry. And this is because we have concentrated production in a few favoured centres, and we've become heavily dependent on fossil fuels and chemical sprays and fertilisers. And frankly, this system that we've now developed here in Australia, which we think is so terrific, producing lots of cheap food, is unsustainable. And I think we're on the brink of another agricultural revolution. That small-scale, diversified, organic market gardening. But a lot of those skills have been lost, and there aren't many people around Bathurst, I've found, who are really seriously interested in what is a fairly labour-intensive industry, but quite a profitable thing to be doing and a very pleasant way of earning a living. We do need to increase the production of products for the local population. We ought to just concentrate on Bathurst as a region. How can we make Bathurst more food secure? How can we increase the production of fresh fruit and vegetables locally, which are the main things we should be really concentrating on from a health point of view, apart from anything else. We are already addressing the need to teach children how to grow their own food. That's a very sensible and pleasant thing to do as a family, to try and grow some of our own food. But in their lifetime, this may be necessary as a matter of survival. Kids who are now learning how to grow fruit and vegetables are going to be in a much stronger position, I think, in the future than we realise. And so there's an increasing number of consumers who are wanting to buy locally grown food, preferably organically grown. This group of people that I'm working with are vitally interested in also supporting the establishment of a local food co-op, which would be owned and controlled by the members, would seek to buy locally grown food and to sell that without a whole lot of unnecessary packaging and storage and processing. So we're hoping that both the production and consumption of locally grown foods will increase by 50% over the next 50 years. That's 1% a year. And if we look at it that way, 1% a year, it's not an unrealistic target. I think we can do it, and I think we should do it.
So with so many, like you said before, that so many farmers have moved out of rural areas and so many people moving into urban areas, is there anything that people living in urban areas can do to start producing, you know, for example, their own food, start producing more organically and reduce that impact on the environment?
Well, they're certainly starting to think about it. There was a wonderful conference held at the University of Western Sydney in Richmond last year, which was around the theme Feeding Sydney. And the notes that came out of that, the reports that came out of that workshop make very interesting and slightly frightening reading. But people who know what's happening and who study these things have are expressing great concern about the growth of our population generally in Australia. So population growth, even in a country like Australia, which we think is a big country with a small population, it's not at all. We have the oldest lands and the least fertile soils and the area of good arable land that can produce crops is really quite tiny. So we're not as well situated as people think. Food security is nationally becoming an issue, driven largely by population growth, but also by global warming.
And I guess with the expansion of Sydney and all that growth moving into the surrounding areas where there is a lot of fertile land, we must be losing what we already have.
Exactly. All the comparatively fertile lands around the Sydney Basin have been taken over by housing. So the area of land available for food production within 50 kilometres of Sydney is diminishing every day. And in another 50 years, there won't be any available for that purpose.
So is it time to start locking off some of these areas and saying this is what we need to do, you know?
Well, I think council's already aware that good agricultural land needs to be conserved, but I'm not sure that community has really understood and embraced the importance.
Never talk politics? That's what we do. Hey, I'm Steph McDonald. This week on Never Talk Politics, we're looking at the food shortage and security issue. Today I'm speaking with Alex Girdwood, a member of the communications team at the Sydney Food Fairness Alliance. The Alliance is a community group that does a lot of advocacy work relating to food security and working towards sustainable food systems. It is made up of many different members from the community who are interested in discussing issues about food security.
The Sydney Food Fairness Alliance is pretty much a grouping of people within Sydney. So we've got health professionals, farmers, people from community bodies and things like that who come together and speak about issues relating to food security. And the aim of the organisation is to develop socially, environmentally and economically sustainable food policies, so to benefit all.
So the Alliance, you've mentioned that the Alliance focuses on working towards food security. I've noticed that you've recently presented a case at New South Wales Parliament about an integrated food policy.
Yes.
Why is a national food policy essential?
Well, food is such an interesting thing, and it doesn't really fall into anyone's profile. It's been a bit on the agenda for the just gone election, and in New South Wales it will be on the agenda for the upcoming election in March. And it's something, like I said, it doesn't really fall into anyone's portfolio, so it's really important, we believe it's really important to establish an independent food council, and that's what the event at Parliament House was all about. It was about gathering MPs who this was relevant to, what food is relevant to inform them on how to develop a food policy council and how to develop effective policies that they have related to that impact on food, be it land, be it, you know, other areas like that.
So I'm also aware that the Alliance organised the Hungry for Change New South Wales Food Summit in October last year.
Yes.
What was the outcome of the summit?
The outcome of the summit was the development of a declaration. Originally it was quite long and we've had to scale it down. So in the 12 months since the food summit, which was last October, we've narrowed it down to a one-page declaration, which we had at the Parliament House event as well. And the declaration is, again, it calls on for the development of an independent food council that would have statewide responsibilities on food security and issues on food supply and things like that.
So you're also involved with the youth food movement. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
It's very exciting. It's a newly formed organisation, and it's pretty much just young people coming together to build a sustainable food future. We're having a launch event as part of the Sydney International Food Festival, so if anyone is coming to Sydney in October, they're more than welcome to join along. And you can find out more information on our Facebook and things like that. But yeah, it's about advocacy, but it's also about young people coming together who like food. So it's about getting that passion of food and the enjoyment of food and making sure we're making choices in a sustainable way. And I mean, young people, that's where you have to start. That's where the change can happen. A lot of older people are kind of stuck in their ways and things like that. So it's really, we believe it's really important to help young people to make informed decisions when it comes to food choices, be it what's healthy, what's, you know, environmentally conscious and things like that.
So how would you like to see things improving regarding food security in the future?
I think it's really, really important to ensure even access of food. That's pretty much what food security is all about, because a lot of people aren't aware that there are pockets within Australia of communities that don't have equal access to a wide range of food, be it nutritious food, be it good quality food, and also the disparity of the cost of food, where junk food and food that doesn't have any nutritional value and is very energy dense is rather cheap and readily available, and then good fruit and vegetables and meats and things like that aren't as readily available and at a higher cost. If you want to get involved with the youth movement, please look us up on Facebook, and you can become a member of the organisation or come along to the events that we put on.
Never talk politics. That's what we do.
So what have we heard on the show today, Steph?
Well, Nick, we've heard that the food shortage issue isn't really getting the attention it needs by the government. Much more commitment to research and really thinking about the issue is needed to ensure a sustainable Australia. We've also realised that there are a lot of community groups that have realised the seriousness of this issue and are lobbying for a national food policy.
Yeah, good stuff. Well, I think we've also realised that small-scale agriculture is often overlooked when it comes to food security. By growing our own food and keeping it local, not only do we help farmers, but we also save the environment from the harm of overproduction. That's all from us on the program this week, but a reminder that if you have something to say on this week's issue, join the Never Talk Politics Facebook group available online. You can also listen to the podcast of this week's show online at nevertalkpolitics2mce.podbean.com.
Never Talk Politics comes to you via the Community Radio Network. Special thanks to the Community Broadcasting Association for financial support. So what track will we leave our listeners out there with today, Nick?
The Kids Don't Stand a Chance by Vampire Weekend, a song that reminds us that someone's going to inherit this world.
Remember, whoever you are and whichever way you lean, keep talking politics.
The devastating backstroke all the way. Should sleep to enhance the pinstripe man in morning. A coming for to dance with pure Egyptian cotton. The kids don't stand a chance.
don't stand a chance.